Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Answer me this, Tony.
Please don't do the accent.
How many ground troops are y'all prepared to commit?
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are here to discuss the 6th episode of season 6 of the Netflix series The Crown. It is called Ruritania. But I've really felt like Jen Maroney is saying...
Rural juror.
Sorry.
My daughter's name is Ruritania, so thanks, guys.
And later, Aaron Vanderhoof is stopping by to talk to us about how those focus groups actually modernized the monarchy and how they were actually really exciting, too.
Let's do a recap of the episode. Queen Elizabeth has a nightmare that King Tony Blair, that is, has taken the crown, and she decides to then soothe her worries by holding a focus group.
Asked if the royal family were out of touch with ordinary people, 69% said yes.
Tony Blair's popularity skyrockets, everything he touches turns to gold, America loves him, and the Queen seeks advice on modernizing the monarchy.
Think of the Crown as a public limited company and the people of Britain as shareholders, not subjects.
I see.
Which takes us to an obscure job fair of the royal household.
Yeoman of the Glass and China Pantry.
Could you tell us what your role involves, day by day?
It's my job to supervise the glassware and earthenware across all the royal palaces.
But when Tony Blair's speech bombs at the Women's Institute, the Queen has a realization.
I think I've come to realize there's no such thing as too royal. If you're doing it, do it properly and unapologetically.
Well, from the tedium of teenage William being adored the world over, we finally got an exciting episode all about Tony Blair.
With word-for-word recreations of Tony Blair speeches.
Yeah, wouldn't you recreate them if you had the chance?
Right.
If you had the platform?
It was really funny and enlightening, too, because my sort of conception of Tony Blair is like Iraq war asshole, like, you know, like kind of loathed later in his career. But to see this period where he really was like a big deal. And that song,
Tony Mania, they called it. Tony,
catchy name. So the Queen has the dream, right, where he's being crowned. The song, our producer told us, was a big labor kind of anthem. They co-opted a pop song by Dream. and made it their big sort of rallying song.
So like the equivalent of the Clintons doing Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow.
Correct. Right. The UK and the US often mirror each other. You know, we have despotic fascists, they have a despotic fascist. We have great New Hope, Blue Dog Democrats who turn out to be kind of like neolib shills, but yeah.
Moderate. Who did it first?
Yeah.
Yes. Who worked better?
Welcome to this episode of Chapo Trap House.
Do we feel that this was an episode that they had to do? Do you know what I mean? Like,
I feel like this Wikipedia page of an episode happened because we have to revisit the queen at some point, I guess.
Yeah.
Because it's called The Crown and she's the one who wears the crown. And this was our only way. I will be shocked, and I'll say it, appalled, if we have another episode that centers on the queen this season, because I feel like we got it. We've told her story. There's not much left really there that is... Mm-hmm.
She's going to be alive for another 20 years.
Well, I don't need to see every episode of that. but yeah, she's going to be alive for a while. I feel like we touched on her because we needed to revisit the queen again. It happened to be quite... boring to me.
I mean, yeah, the Queen Blair clash is not as interesting as the Diana royal family clash.
Or Will and his father clashing.
And they've got similar kind of vibes, which is like modernism versus traditionalism. Mm-hmm. Like, as the episode may have hammered home a couple of times.
No, you don't say.
They really laid it on thick.
Yeah, Peter Morgan seems to have a special affinity for Tony Blair also, which is, I think, probably why he felt like he had to. He has written not one, not two, but three movies about Tony Blair.
He might just have a type, because Prince Charles, Tony Blair, there's something going on there.
Yeah.
Type of guy that he likes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we did probably need some policy episodes, like, you know, or one policy episode this season that has been a hallmark of the show in the past, dealing with political issues.
Reminding us that the royal family actually have some sort of governmental role, kind of.
Exactly.
Yeah, too much,
exactly.
If you ask me.
But, like, I think that this push and pull between modernity and, you know, tradition and all that stuff has been better laid out in previous episodes. I also think maybe inadvertently the show is reducing the crown and its members, like the royalty, to just these weird, petty people obsessed with image above everything else. Mm-hmm. How are we polling? Blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I get, maybe that's intentional to show that that's really what they were reduced to, is people scrambling to justify themselves, you know? But it's not terribly compelling as television, no.
Yes.
I guess.
Yeah. Dramatically, narratively. Yeah. I mean, it is funny, though, to get the project of at least this season and maybe the entire series laid so bare when the queen just literally comes out and says, like, tradition is good. Mm-hmm. It's important to, like, form a national identity around. Like, I understand that it's silly to have a man whose entire job is like watching
Warden of the Swan
is watching the glassware and folding our napkins.
Put some respect on their names.
However, we've gone through this list like person by person and determined that they are all completely essential to the project of the monarchy, and the monarchy cannot change and it will not change. The end. Goodbye.
I think that was very clear. That was the arc of the whole episode. And that was clear that it's like, okay, tradition is important. But then the thing that was like a little insidious and a little bit interesting, I'll say, and a little bit like, ooh, like, is this how you feel? It's like, we're better than everybody. We need to elevate. We elevate everyone. Everyone comes to us. It was very like, we come to this place for magic.
Yeah, people want magic and mystery.
When they brush up against us, they want the magic and the mystery and the arcane and the eccentric and the symbolic and the transcendent. They want to feel like they've entered another world. That is our duty. To lift people up and transport them into another realm, not bring them down to earth and remind them of what they already have.
Hearing that didn't make you want to stand up and salute?
No, it did not transport me in the way that Nicole Kidman's AMC ad transported me when she said the same thing about AMC. No, it really scared me that that's the way that they viewed themselves and their justification for taking notes. It's interesting. The queen is like taking notes all episode, but she's not going to take, the queen isn't going to take a note. She's not going to cut her bed wagoner person or bed yeoman because Tony Blair tells her to cut the bed yeoman. And I think the justification, which in a pretty sort of dull episode, that little, well, we're special and we should be treated as such. That was kind of interesting to me.
Well, and according to the show, that's a good thing.
Like, yeah,
the show agrees with that.
And the show is like, that's the thesis statement of the episode. And that is true. And that's like, I don't know if I feel that way.
Yeah. I mean, so she does this focus group, right? And 69% of the 2,000 subjects polled said that the crown was out of touch with people. And then at the end of the episode, they say, good, they should be.
Good. We like that. Similar to what you said last episode, I would have liked if there was just an episode of the focus group. Like, that could have been interesting to see.
Oh,
like,
yeah, kind of like a bottle episode or a play. Sorry, forgive me, Catherine. I'm probably not using that term.
A standalone episode.
Yeah, because I think that in the same way that it was interesting once in a very rare while to see people outside of the Roy family react to these people, I would like a little bit of, like, here's a regular English person, and what do they make of all this, you know, because we're so cloistered. I know that's partly the point, but, like, this episode of them just, like, fuddy-duddying around about, like, their little weird
stuff. The Queen's herb strewer.
Yeah, it just was, like, a little bit, I don't know, I felt a little bit sort of smothered by it, I guess, in a way. Not to say that, you know, Imelda Staunton is great.
She is, but it also, you know, it's a there's a protesting too much aspect to it, too, which is, like, if the royals, if the magic and all of this, like, actually is so important, like, why does it have to keep defending itself?
Yeah, why do I not feel it? It's not Disneyland. I'm not...
Well, it's the way that, like hard right, you know, conservative politicians in the U.S. will, or, like, news people will constantly refer to what the American people want. And you're like, but the American people, like, do vote for progressive things. It's the same thing with this, where it's like, no, like, people want the mystery. Which people?
Yeah. Who are you?
Show me the, who are under the age of 70.
You know? Because people, the majority think that you're a waste of their money.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. And don't understand what your function is.
And, yeah, people who don't directly work for you and want to keep them there. Yeah, of course, like, you know, the warden of the swans is going to talk about how much the swans matter. Yeah.
You know what that job pays? I mean, come on. You know that's a cushy role.
I will say, okay, so again, to be fair to Peter Morgan, he does provide sort of the other side of it with Tony Blair's wife when she's, like, going off on the crown. And, I mean, this line did get me, that when she's like,
it's an anachronistic, unrepresentative feudal system based on 1,000 years of hereditary privilege.
Woo! I was like, that's a really good way to put it, actually.
Yeah. And the show did genuinely seem, the writing did seem genuinely ambivalent. Like, I feel like it was, like, it wasn't painting Tony Blair's wife as, like, wrong or strident or, like, too...
Some kind of crazy radical,
Exactly. It was like, that's fair, you know.
A viewpoint that clearly a lot of people in Britain share.
And it's ambivalent until the last scene where Tony Blair woofs it at the Women's Institute. Well, he, you know, absolutely swings and misses there. And then the queen gets to sit in her little green outfit and be like, well, I'm special and you're not.
Yeah. I know how to do
well,
that.
Well, and being like, not everything is about politics, which is...
Fair.
Yeah, I guess if you're talking about electoral politics, although one could argue, I suppose, everything is about politics all the time, which is not really a track that this show is necessarily taking, but...
But it so clearly aligned itself with the Queen and the Royals in, like, ending with Tony, you know, on a low and coming back to the Queen, being like, oh, you messed up at this event where I killed it, and I'm better than you, and always will be.
Do you feel like this episode gave, like, a good impression of Blair's personality more as, or was he just kind of not an antagonist even necessarily, as, like, an opposing force? Like, do you think that you got a sense of him as a guy, as a politician?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's hard to look through, to kind of peer through the scrim of, like, Peter Morgan's affection for him. I mean, the way he's talked about, he has the Queen saying, like, you have famously excellent instincts and all, you know, like, complimenting his political prowess. And with the, you know, the benefit of hindsight now, we can be like, well, no, he made some huge, colossal
not
mistakes.
Not until 2003, like, but...
Yeah,
right.
Yet,
it was a few years away. And, like, look, the bombing in Kosovo, that's also still a matter of some, controversy from various sides of that conflict.
Although the show doesn't seem like it's trying to, like, gotcha him. It's not using that foreshadowing of irony. No. It's like, no, you actually are this, like, incredible
politician.
With these once-in-a-generation instincts. And, there's not really any kind of extra gloss on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think speaking to the necessity of this episode, Tony Blair was such a huge, like, phenomenon, kind of, like, a cultural political force, that you couldn't really not do something about him. Yes, Morgan has done a lot with him in the past, but, like, he needed to really get some kind of episode here. I almost wish that they had waited till it was, like, 9/11 reaction time and Iraq war time.
But I guess that doesn't have as much to do with the Queen or the royals.
Well,
themselves.
She did 9/11.
Yeah.
Didn't you know that?
Yeah, they don't tell you that, but that's true. It's true.
Oh, my God. It all finally falls together, the pieces.
Yeah, she was mad at the corgis and decided to...
God, if I see one more shot of her throwing a ball to some corgis.
Well, I love in this episode, she's like, go get it. She throws something, the dog runs after it, and then she turns to, like, do the rest of the scene, and the dog is just fully gone. It's like not...
Never
like, it's just
back.
Disappeared.
It like, ran away. She's got 16 others, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
God, I mean, this episode of How the Queen Got a Groove Back was her relationship with Tony...
kind of interesting, but not enough to sustain. Like, why didn't we cut to Camilla or the kids or, like, to have a full episode?
That's true. It was very focused on her and him.
Her and him, which I don't know how much gas there was there.
And it just, especially because we just went through this with Diana. Mm-hmm. That person's popular, but I'm the queen. Why am I not more popular?
Everybody should love me.
Like, we've done that. We've done that with the queen. We've done that with Charles. It just starts to feel a little bit like, isn't there something to be said about the Blair-Elizabeth relationship that isn't that particular dynamic?
Yeah.
Maybe there isn't. I don't know.
And I don't know how often are, like, the queen, like, way into, like, the national or the international, you know, politics of it all. But, like, I feel like it sort of glossed over, like, any sort of response she had to, like, the, you know, the war in Kosovo. Like, it wasn't really about, like, the royal family's relationship to international events beyond being like, I can name the president of Malawi and things like that. That's sort of interesting. Like, of course, Tony Blair is sort of taking up air. He's speaking to actual events that are happening in the world right now.
Because he's the actual prime minister
with actual political power and whatnot. And you're sitting on your throne telling little jokes to biddies in northern England.
You're like 2 minutes away from storming the Bastille.
Yeah. It's just like, I think that is the political aspect of the Queen's, I think that could be explored, but maybe it shouldn't be more explored because she didn't really do that. I don't really know the Queen's thoughts on international affairs.
Yeah, I don't know. I think back to 9/11. I don't have any idea what she said or did.
Yeah.
If she said or did anything.
No. She said or did anything.
Yeah. I mean, I think
I remember what Jon Stewart said and did.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that, like, I guess it's my understanding, maybe one of you told me this, but, like, that William and Kate are very popular in the UK, but I think that's only out of people who like the royals, you know, who like the monarchy.
Well, their wedding was a huge deal.
Enormous, I woke up for that.
Enormous deal. But, like, you kind of also wonder, was that enormous because they made it like that? They made it a spectacle. They blocked off streets. They allocated funds, you know, whatever it was. Like, but this, something about the tilt into, like, the new millennium, all that, this really is where this entire institution starts to, I don't know, look increasingly untenable. Mm-hmm. And so in that regard, like, using Blair as the sort of catalyst for Elizabeth realizing she has an image problem and then doubling down on the tradition, like, that's interesting because this is going to plague this family for the rest of their time on Earth and the rest of the institution's existence. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm of the belief that we could see the end of this in our lifetimes.
Oh,
you know?
It seems entirely possible. Or if not an entire, like, sweeping them out kind of thing, then certainly a reduction in some massive way.
Well, they keep talking in this episode about what if you did it more like the Dutch do or the Swedish do, where they really are not, they're very just, like, symbolic and they're not, you know, taking money from taxpayers or whatever.
And appointing the prime minister. When I heard that, I was like, what?
Yeah.
I guess,
well,
like, not how technically, I know, but it's just like, I was like, that's so antiquated. But then they do the Prince Philip always there to defend the queen and being like, well, the queen is rejected 3 times before she comes to the House of Commons because it shows that if you overstep, then your head will be cut off.
Yeah, this does make me wonder how the monarchy already has changed, like, since Charles took over. I don't actually know the answer.
Well, because this show positions him as something of the great reformer.
Right.
He's more forward-minded. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, who knows? But, like, what is it? We see sort of an example of it in this episode. Like, what do they call it? The firm?
Mm-hmm.
The sort of, like, infrastructure surrounding the royal family. And it's often implied that they're the ones who are sort of ruthlessly preserving this for their, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we see that with her advisors a little bit.
The big emotional climax of the episode, which I'm sorry I wasn't moved, was when Robert, her chief of staff, is like, I'm actually going to step down and sacrifice myself to make it seem like there's change that's happening within here and you'll get a better advisor and I'll get to play more cricket and the queen has moved and I was mostly asleep. But but I do think that's part of the change in the firm.
I wish we had known more about him and kind of understood more why this would have been a big deal for Elizabeth specifically. I don't know if there was so much time spent just watching Tony Blair ask for aid to Kosovo.
Yeah, ground troops. Put him on the ground.
Doing absolutely awful Clinton impressions, both of them, husband and wife.
That was.
And she's like, mine's better. It's like, no, it's not.
Okay. Back to the Wikipedia of it all. I didn't know the Clintons were there when George Bush was elected. That's kind of fun.
That's wild, yeah.
That's kind of wild that they were on their farewell. There were a lot of, like, little things like that were like, ooh, if I read that in a history book, I'd be like,
fun fact,
I'd underline it, but I don't need to see it play out on my screen. Or, like, let's get the Clintons. Let's call up Clive Owen and get Edie Falco and let's the Clintons in there. Right.
I would have thrilled to that. There was a Jackie and John Kennedy episode. Like, why not?
I was making myself laugh watching this episode, remembering, I was going to say to you guys, remember when Jackie O was on, Jackie Kennedy was on The Crown for, like, a whole episode?
Got to go back to that. That was before my time.
Oh, but I would have. It's a weird, like, one-off episode. Yeah.
I would have loved to seen them. Yeah.
And that was also like, oh, these guys are so, like, young and popular and cool, and I'm this, like, old fuddy-duddy. Like, that is just a recurring, and that was in, like, season three? That's a long time ago.
I think it was even more.
Even season two?
Yeah. Because she's already queen, but she's still Claire Foy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, so the early 60s.
Yeah, and she feels like the unglamorous fuddy-duddy compared to Jackie Kennedy. So anyway, yeah, this is a recurring theme on the show. And obviously, look, for good reason. I mean, like, you had one queen who was in the role for 70-something years. And I think there was a sort of sentiment among people in the UK that was like, okay, can we just be done when she's done, though? Mm-hmm. You know, like, we'll let her live it out for the rest of her time, and then, like, we're not going to care about someone new.
Yeah. Wrap it up. I will say something that I did enjoy about this episode, we got a little bit of Princess Margaret, we got a little bit of, you know, having the whole family get together and be crazy together was kind of fun.
We have to assume that there's a bigger Margaret. I mean, you don't put Leslie Manville in that role and not give her a showcase,
I'm afraid that her showcase was last season.
I would have to assume there is another Margaret episode coming, but I would love more all of them in a room, you know, doing August Osage County, you know, like,
because it is
fun to even just get the
Queen Mom.
Exactly. To get that stage picture of, like, oh, Margaret's sitting by the window and there's Charles, and, you know, it's just like, right, here they all are together.
Oh, and wait, was that Prince Andrew? What's up with him?
Yes.
What's he doing in the early 2000s?
That briefly was Prince Andrew. Mm-hmm. They have very studiously kept him
out of
this world.
They are keeping him in the shadows.
Because Anne gets a little to do, you know, especially this season. But yeah, Andrew, it's like, I don't think they're going to do much with him.
Pretend like he's not there.
But then why bother giving him a line in this? You know, I don't know.
So I guess we'll never see Beatrice or Fergie or, you know, any.
I don't think any of that.
Any of that.
Well, because the Fergie stuff was.
Would have already happened.
That was more mid-90s, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? Touched upon it briefly.
I mean, if we see William and Kate's wedding, we got to see those hats.
Those fascinators.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm assuming that wedding. Will that be the end of it?
I mean, Charles and Camilla's wedding could also be the last thing we see.
That would be more fitting for this show.
Yeah, that adds, that closes an arc in a way.
Because if they go up to the Queen's death, they can't just skate over Harry and Meghan.
No.
They're going to end before Meghan. Yeah. I think Peter Morgan has said that.
Yeah, no,
we shouldn't
he's not
expect.
Tackling Meghan.
Well, because that would make the show actually confront some truths about this family.
Yeah, that they skirt around.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, either that or they blame the entire thing on Meghan, which is
more
something
likely
that they could do.
They would never blame a woman on this show.
A person of color? Are you crazy?
Yeah, no, come on.
It would be fun if Meghan played Meghan, though. She has a Netflix deal, you know?
The role of a lifetime.
Crazier things have happened.
It would be funny if the episode opens with her shooting an episode of Suits. So they get the Suits cast, which is now a hit on Netflix.
Yeah. Now that's synergy.
Yeah. Can you tell we don't have a ton to say about this particular episode? We're talking about Suits.
We could just talk entirely about
Suits. We're doing our best.
I just hope we're done. Even though the narrative of the Crown's relevance continues to this day in real life, I think for the purposes of this show, we get it. We've covered it. This episode ends with her saying, bully to all that. I'm just going to be my crazy old self anyway. You know, like, okay, done.
We've concluded
the question of whether the Crown should exist.
We know what the show thinks. Now, give us a character.
Yeah.
We've got, what, 4 episodes left? 7, 8, 9, 10? Yeah. We don't have any more space for this conversation.
No, we got to get Margaret in there. We got to get a Harry episode. Mm-hmm. We got to get a wedding of some kind.
And we got to get Kate.
Yeah.
I got to meet Kate.
I'm excited.
It's coming.
Yeah.
It's coming.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
At eBay, you'll always get that feel of real because your fashion purchase will be backed by authenticity guarantee. Whether it's an it bag, a must-have watch, dreamy jewelry, or fire sneakers and fresh streetwear, every step will feel authentic, every flex will feel real. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal with eBay Authenticity Guarantee. Visit ebay.com for terms.
So the start of this episode was all about the focus groups.
We're going to have to phone a friend to help explain why these were so important, because the three of us aren't really feeling it.
But you know what? We had the perfect person to talk to.
Yes,
we roped in Erin Vanderhoof. She's Vanity Fair's Royal Watcher and co-host of Our Dynasty podcast. So welcome, Erin.
Hello.
So, Erin, thanks for being here. I'm particularly grateful because the three of us have had a hard time trying to find the excitement in this whole focus group plotline. So I think that you are going to come bearing actual facts. Why were these a big deal? Why was this kind of this era for the monarchy such a worth covering on The Crown?
I think that to me, this episode was just very clearly. I think Peter Morgan has said before that he was a not particularly political labor voter. Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, he is maybe a little too enamored with the Tony Blair mythology. Mm-hmm. And so he's using it. The focus groups happened at the time, but I think that it's pretty, what I think this episode really doesn't get quite right is that they happened immediately in the aftermath of Diana's death. It was part of a larger strategy that had been going on for about 15 years of, okay, nothing at this place has changed since 1917. Maybe we should do something different.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And what those focus groups are really supposed to do is figure out what do people want to see in a monarchy? What are the things that they like about the system as it exists right now? What are the things that the people think should be better? And, I went back to Sally Bodell Smith has this amazing 2012 book about Queen Elizabeth where she actually just lists all of the different attributes that the focus group kind of came up with. It didn't come up with we need to change. We have to do that. It just kind of said the things that they do like already and the things that they thought they needed to work on. So it wasn't a huge deal, but one of the things that they did find is that support for the monarchy is relatively constant over generations, decades, regardless of the ups and downs of the headlines. So I feel like it wasn't really used for that purpose in the episode, but
what did they find that was negative? What were the worst findings?
Oh, just that young people thought that the family was out of touch. Yeah.
Heard that on The Crown before.
Yeah, myopic and out of touch, which...
Okay. Okay, so they don't see the beauty of the Queen's herb strewer in the same way.
The yeoman of the bedchamber.
Yeah. Well, once again, that's one of those things that actually had started to change about a decade previous, is that really what happened, Tony Blair did wind up cutting the family's budget pretty significantly, but that's partially because Margaret Thatcher had given them a bit too much. They had invested it, and they came out of 1999 with a $40 million pound rainy day fund. So then Tony Blair cut the budget.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, speaking of Tony Blair, he is a large focus of this episode. He's obviously a favorite topic for Peter Morgan. Tell us about the relationship between the Queen and Tony Blair in real life.
Yeah, they had a pretty cordial relationship. Tony Blair has given a bunch of interviews about the Queen, but is always very, very, very specific to never sort of let slip what they actually talked about. But he is always saying, that when they first met, she did a good job of simultaneously reminding him who had the seniority in the relationship while also making him feel at ease. And so I feel like that's one of those things that I think I struggle with Imelda Staunton, is that I feel like there's in all of the reporting I've ever done, people always say, like, the queen laughs a lot. She's really wry. She's really silly. And, you know, that's something I don't get.
You're not getting that from Imelda's
performance? I'm not getting it.
From Dolores Umbridge?
Yeah. You're not getting it silly for Queen?
I feel like the dream, back to the Queen and Tony Blair, you know, they definitely had disagreements. And Cherie Blair, Tony's wife, was actually a pretty ardent, you know, small R Republican and was not a fan of the monarchy. So I did kind of like that they added in that. But in general, I think Tony Blair was, you know, he's like such a complicated figure in modern British history, because on the one hand, like, he was very, very, very popular and successful at the things that he set out to do, sort of like modernizing the image of the Labour Party and like making sure that people realized that, you know, it wasn't just conservatives who could have, like, fiscal responsibility. But on the other hand, I think that he is, you know, he had to step down because of, you know, unpopularity related to the Iraq War. And I think that in this episode, you do kind of get that twin nature of his legacy. But I think that it's harder to tell what the Queen kind of would, you know, it's hard to tell what she would have thought about each one of those individual things. But one thing that I do think is that the episode captures well, but with a little twist, is that Tony Blair really did go to the Women's Institute and just bomb.
Oh, really?
We've got
real hard.
Yeah, June 7th, 2000 in The Guardian, we've got heckled, jeered, booed. Blair bombs at the Women's Institute.
Ooh, wow. Yeah. What exactly is the Women's Institute?
obviously know. We know what that is, but if somebody didn't know what that
is. No, if you were talking to, say, a moron, what would you tell them? Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's kind of funny. We in the U.S. used to have a lot more clubs like this, but it's like a local clubs composed of women, usually middle-aged to elderly, that get together for, you know, meetings and, like, community service projects and, you know, just as, like, kind of a social club or organization. One of the things that they really don't like is party politics. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that Blair went up and said, like, it's, you know, I want to do radical things. I want change. I want newness.
They just really don't want to talk about politics at all.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. What it was is that he had apparently just come back from taking some time off from paternity leave, and he started out by kind of talking about his family. And the gloss that a lot of reporters put on it is, like, the purpose of this was to establish, like, Labour can be into traditional family values, too. Mm-hmm. But then Tony Blair starts talking about egalitarianism and then starts talking about all of the things that his government has done to promote opportunity and equality and, like, inclusivity. But those are, like, specific, you know, policy portion. Right. So that's the things that then get the Women Institute really mad. I think what rings really true about that in the episode to me is that the Queen was so good at, she is the quintessential, like, British grandma. So when she's in a room full of British grandmas, she's good at giving that
target audience.
Yeah, and that she's good at giving people what they want at any moment in time. And I think that clearly Tony Blair is a person who is, you know, a politician.
One thing that, you know, I was sort of taken aback by in this episode is this kind of concluding thing. I mean, maybe I'm reading it just one particular way, but, like, where the Queen's like, oh, you know what? Actually, the old traditions are good, in fact, you know, and because Tony Blair biffed it at this speech, like, it proves, you know, that actually we don't need to get rid of the swan guy or whatever.
And nothing has to change ever at the end.
Do you think that the Crown, I mean, this may be a dumb question, is the Crown, like, a royalist show?
Oh, it's a great question. I mean, so even Peter Morgan has said that he kind of came into this with that sort of, you know, not very political, but soft Labour voter attitude that, like, oh, the Queen is such a cute grandma, but, like, you know, it's weird to have a monarchy in the 21st century. And he said that working on the show kind of made him change his mind and, like, actually come to actually believe that the royals are doing some good things for the nation. And, you know, I think that that's, like, a pretty common experience for anybody looking at that because, you know, you have affection for them. But I think that this is maybe where, as much as I think that in the last season, Imelda Staunton was really working for me as the Queen in her, you know, having a bad year, where she was working less for me here, is just that increasingly the way that the queen would push boundaries of like what was allowed and what wasn't is through humor, is through being really ingratiating. You know, I always think of the hilarious 2012 video where she and Daniel Craig are like doing a James Bond thing for the London Olympics.
That's right, you know,
that's clearly violating a couple of old rules about propriety, but they made sense for her. They helped her kind of become that pop culture icon, that unifying figure. And so I think that she was always the type of person who, in service of the crown, has to change to be relevant to people. We have to do things. So, I mean, clearly, I think, you know, even if you think about reading Spare, like, near the end of her life, I think that she really did kind of keep to a lot of traditions, but she was clearly pretty wry about them. Mm-hmm. I think that the moment I always think of is, like, Harry goes out to ask his grand— he says he went out to ask his grandmother permission to marry Meghan, and he's nervous, and he's like, oh, I have to ask you permission to do this. And she's like, oh, do you? Well, I suppose I have to say yes.
That's what. So I guess maybe, like, one final question. What is the general attitude toward the royal family now? Have there been more focus groups since in the last 25 years? Where does it all stand today?
So many focus groups. So many. It's one of the most frequently polled questions. You know, like, one of the bookmark tabs on my computer is, like, the quarterly tracker of popularity, just because it is kind of fun to look at.
Has their popularity declined?
A little bit, but not much. Like, even, you know, over the last year, we've had tons of news about Harry and Meghan and Will and Kate and Charles and his behavior and all of that. Over the last year, everybody took a slight hit in popularity. Charles is actually kind of just back to where he was, like, around the time the Queen died. Nowadays, 2/3 of Britain still says that the monarchy makes Britain a better place and that they don't see themselves going for a republic. The one thing that is actually different, though, is unprecedented numbers of young people say that they don't really see the purpose of the monarchy. And in the past, young people have always said, okay, like, we don't like the monarchy. But then, as they get older, those opinions turn to change. What they're saying is that now, like, levels of Gen Z and, you know, people who are now turning 18, they disapprove of the monarchy at, like, rates that are just way more than even millennials when we were in that position. And so that's the one, like, once again, reaching out to young people, reaching out to the fact that, or, like, responding to the fact that Britain is way more multicultural, just like it was 26 years ago, is still, like, the main concern that they all have.
So the Harry Meghan stuff and the way that the family was, you know, did not behave well towards Meghan Markle, at least from what I've read, that didn't, that, 'cause that to me felt kind of fatal to the family.
Well, everybody, every single individual person's popularity took a hit. Harry's did, and Meghan's. In Britain, they're super unpopular.
Because they left?
I mean, it started, their popularity started going down around the time that they left, and then over the last few years. I mean, it's like, I think that Meghan is like, Meghan and Harry are both, like, still in the papers every day, even though they don't do anything. So, it's, you know. But Will and Kate, Charles, Camilla, everyone's popularity took a hit after the Netflix show, after the biography, after Spare. But it's, you know, they just kind of go float back up. And even so, like, the idea of a monarchy is way less affected by even those scandals than you would think.
Wow. All right. Well, I think I care about the focus groups now.
so job well done. If I were to pull you, Richard, and say, do you think the focus groups are a good way to determine the future of the monarchy?
Yes, I'm favorable, I guess. But yeah,
right, put it in your notebook, Eric.
Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, a trip down memory lane as we see what gems make our time capsule.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
So I don't know if you noticed, but we're in the 2000s now. The Crown has gotten to the 2000s, but, you know, we're in the future now, and yet we can also be nostalgic. So let's look back into the time capsule. And what grabbed you guys from this sort of, like, Y2K era of this episode?
Yeah, I guess it would have to be the Clintons, just the invocation of that election, because that's one of the first political events that I remember. I was in the third grade. Like, this is like what was, you know, my parents were talking about it on the dinner table, how terrible, how, you know, democracy was ending, which would happen.
How democracy was ending because Al Gore kept contesting the election.
Yes, they love George Bush. Should I? No, it's sort of the opposite. But that sort of brought me back to be like, oh, I could actually finally place myself in terms of, oh, when this was happening, I was this age in this place in my life. And, like, you know, dressing up as Harry Potter for Halloween.
Yeah, that's, no, I remember the intensity of that season very, very well also, because I was 12, and it was like Bill Clinton, as far as I was concerned, had always been the president for, like, my entire life.
Yeah,
was the president, yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, then suddenly everything just went all crazy. Hanging Chads.
Chads, a hanging Chad. I knew what that was when I was, you know?
You know what I don't watch this show for? Horrifying reminders of U.S. politics. Keep this shit out of the Crown. I don't want to see George W. Bush on the Crown. Come on, guys.
You don't want to see him and Tony Blair, like, planning the invasion of Iraq together?
Twirling
their mustache.
Yeah. So in the dream that the Queen has at the beginning of the episode, our producer, Emily, thinks there's kind of a Ginger Spice lookalike. Like, maybe somehow Ginger Spice had gotten its way into the Queen's consciousness enough for her to dream about her. Jerry Horner in real life is a big Tory, so it wouldn't make that much sense that she'd be in Tony Blair's coronation, but the Queen might not know that in 2000.
Maybe he was so beloved in the Queen's mind that he got Ginger Spice to come on the other side.
At this point, she had left the Spice Girls.
Is that right?
It's the year 2000, yeah.
Oh, my God.
She left, like, right after Spice World.
Ugh, one of my favorite
movies. I guess, yeah, the first Spice Girl song was, like, 96 or something, right? So they had been around for a few years.
It's been a while. It's longer than you think, yeah.
Yeah. So I think the nostalgia in this episode or the time capsule stuff actually was mostly bad. Like, it was not...
Either that or I think it's probably... You're going to feel it more if you were in Britain or knew a lot about Britain in this time period, because there's not a ton of pop culture kind of stuff, since it's so focused
political.
You know, the Queen's pillow fluffer or whatever.
The sticks, the gold stick and the silver stick in waiting. That's where the time capsule was. It's back a time capsule to 1500.
Exactly. It's the year 2000, but actually it's 1500. It's actually a lion in winter.
Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. As ever, you can find me on social media apps like X and Instagram at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
You can find me on those same apps at Chris Triss.
And you can find me at Tony Blair Lover 15151.
Oh, that's your screen name.
It is, yeah. Oh my God, if
from
only.
From AOL, AIM.
Okay, actually though, it's Hillabuster. What's yours?
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. Stick around. Next up in the feed is episode 7. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.